cannons in the distance, drums in my chest, big black cloud blowing down from the west. The saints are bowling, static in the air. Peter hit a split, give Judas spare.
Can you imagine being in a hurricane? I mean, the actual storm as it swirls and churns in the ocean. Noted hurricane researcher Dr. Kerry Emanuel paints quite a picture of one of nature's fiercest storms and says they can carry clues as to why our global climate is changing. That's the main focus of this week's Jet Streaming.
Way up on the fences, oh Lord, save us all. Praying in the cellar, Satan shaking the walls. This old farm is all we got. A thunder rolling across our...
We are back as always. I'm Kathy Werzer along with Paul Huttner and Dr. Mark Seely. How are you guys?
Good, Kathy. Doing well today.
Nice. For a rainy week, I'm doing okay.
So far, so good. Well, in the past 30-some-odd segments of Jet Streaming, this is number 30, by the way, if you're counting, we've had some pretty well-known guests in the world of weather, and today's guest is in that stratosphere. Dr. Kerry Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT. He's the author of a number of books, including one of the most popular science books in recent years, Divine Wind: The History and Science of Hurricanes. Dr. Emanuel was also named Time Magazine's 100 People Who Shaped the World for his latest research, which correlates the greater increasing hurricane intensity with human-induced global warming. Hope I got all that right, Dr. Emanuel. How are you? Welcome.
Just fine. A little wet.
A little bit. Yeah, sorry about that. It's an honor to have you. And I'm curious, we'll start here and then we'll just take it wherever we want to go. Do you feel it's a matter of when, not whether, there will be another Hurricane Katrina?
I think it is, unfortunately, a matter of when and not whether. Katrina is seen by many people to be a meteorological catastrophe, but it wasn't, really. It was a man-made catastrophe. Katrina was not meteorologically that unusual. We were just set up for disaster. And one would have hoped that in the wake of Katrina, we might have contemplated our policies and so on in this country that set us up for disaster, but we have not. All those policies that led to the disaster are still in place. And we continue to migrate to coastal regions in very large numbers, like lemmings marching to the sea. And as long as that continues, the next one might even be worse.
So certainly lessons not learned at this point.
Mm.
Dr. Emanuel, you had a what I guess we could call a very timely essay in the journal Nature, August of 2005, just before Katrina, showing the destructive potential of hurricanes increasing significantly since the 1970s. And you cite longer storm lifetimes, greater storm intensities as causes for the increase. How much of an overall warming signal have we seen with regard to tropical sea surface temperatures? And what can we deduce about future hurricane intensities based on the trend of warmer tropical oceans?
Well, we've seen about a half a degree centigrade, roughly a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in the tropical Atlantic temperature over the last 100 years, but most of that's occurred in the last 30 years. In the last 30 years, where we have decent measurements, the power of hurricanes, literally the amount of energy they release over the lifetime of the storm and over the season, has about doubled. We're very puzzled about that. We do have a body of theory and models that told us that it shouldn't be anything like that sensitive. And so when we use the same theory and models to project into the future warming, we don't see nearly as much an increase in power as we've already seen. And the only thing I can tell you about that is that it's a paradox, and it reveals, unfortunately, our continued ignorance of this problem. Nature is sending us a different signal than we expected to see.
Mark Seely, you have studied Dr. Emanuel's theories and some research. When we start delving into it, what really strikes a chord with you?
Well, I'm wondering, we seem to have a body of knowledge that is growing leaps and bounds in terms of North Atlantic tropical storm and hurricane systems, Kerry, and I know you're well versed in this. I'm wondering if we still have some knowledge gaps elsewhere, for example, in the Western Pacific with respect to the nature and character of tropical storm development in that region of the globe. Are we about on par with our knowledge of the North Atlantic, or do we still have much more to learn over there?
We have a lot more to learn. The Atlantic, it's important to understand, has only 11% of the global total of hurricanes, which we call tropical cyclones generically. The Atlantic is also, unfortunately, the only place on the planet that we routinely fly airplanes into hurricanes and measure them. We used to do that in the Western Pacific up until 1987, and that stopped. So arguably, we know less about what's going on there than we knew 20 years ago, and that's tragic. There is the notion that satellites have solved all our measurement problems. Far from it. They're wonderful in detecting that there are hurricanes there, but they're less useful for quantifying how strong the hurricane is, how hot it is in its center, and so on. We really need to do a much better job measuring these storms if we can hope to understand them.
I'm curious what you thought of the two hurricanes that were initially seemed fairly tame and then picked up an incredible amount of steam in a very short period of time over narrow bodies of fairly warm water and did extensive damage. When you heard about those storms, what did you think?
Well, the first thing that we try to do is try to put it in historical context. And there again, we have the history that over most of the time that we have hurricane records, we weren't flying airplanes in and didn't have satellites to pick up on really rapid intensification. So we don't, it's the same problem. We don't really know how often that occurs. We also know theoretically that the more powerful a hurricane could become in any given environment, we know how to calculate that. It's also true that going along with it, the more rapidly it can intensify. And those were in very, very good thermodynamic environments, those two storms.
How would you tweak hurricane models to reflect this possibility?
Well, here we have an interesting problem. The global models that are used to predict climate and are getting better at it slowly are far too coarse to simulate hurricanes. You know, they're operating on chunks of atmosphere that are 100 miles in dimension, and you could fit a whole hurricane inside one of those blocks. You can't resolve it, basically. And they try. They get these very weak things, but, you know, nobody really thinks that you can determine hurricane climatology from today's climate model. So we have to do something a bit different. And typically what we do is we take very specialized, highly resolved hurricane models and embed them in the climate models. And that's one way of trying to understand, and we call that downscaling, by the way. It's one way of trying to understand how hurricanes might respond to climate. And we're beginning to learn quite a bit from that exercise about how hurricanes might evolve in the future.
Interesting. Dr. Seeley, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask. Earlier this year, we lost the head of the National Hurricane Center. And part of that was based on the public perception that some of his statements were degrading the public's confidence in the National Hurricane Center. And I'm wondering, in terms of their surveillance as well as their deployment and use of these models, do you see them continuing to improve in this arena as time goes on? And is that technology being exported to the other world centers that are responsible for tropical cyclone forecasting in other regions?
That's an excellent question. If you look at the recent history of hurricane forecasts by the National Hurricane Center in the United States, in one respect, they're improving tangibly. That is, we're getting better and better and better at forecasting where hurricanes will go. The laws of chaos in the atmosphere forbid us from ever being perfect about that, but we're getting close to being as good as we can get. On the other hand, on the flip side, in forecasting the strength of hurricanes, and we just talked about the fact that they can change very rapidly and unexpectedly, there's been no improvement at all that we can see over the last 30 years. That partly reflects our ignorance of the physics underlying the intensity of hurricanes, partly reflects the coarseness of the models, which much more seriously affect their ability to predict intensity. But also reflects a measurement problem. And until very recently, even atmospheric scientists believed that to forecast hurricanes, you just had to do a bang-up job measuring the atmosphere in and around hurricanes. And of course, it's true that you do. But it also turns out to be true that you have to know what the temperature, not just of the surface of the ocean is, but all the way down to a few hundred feet. And the reason for that is that hurricanes churn up cold water, and they limit their intensity that way. Well, most hurricanes don't live up to their thermodynamic potential because they bring cold water to the surface and that tends to weaken them. To predict that, you actually have to know the temperature below the surface. In practice, we don't. We don't have a lot of measurements in the ocean. It's much harder body of fluid to measure because you can't send radio waves through it, so you can't send an instrument down and have it radio the information back. Sounds like a small technical hurdle, but it's enormous. And so this is really holding back the prediction of hurricane intensity. So to the second part of your question, to some extent, we have exported some know-how about forecasting. But it's not just forecasting, because there is the response to the forecast. And you can have a perfect forecast, but if there's not a plan to evacuate, or if, as in the case of New Orleans and Katrina, the plan wasn't effective or wasn't implemented correctly, it's all for naught. And so, in Hurricane Mitch in Honduras in 1999, 11 or 12,000 deaths, the forecast of the storm, including the floods, wasn't so bad. But there was no way, really, to deal with getting people out of harm's way. And, you know, we have all kinds of social problems there. So in the United States, if a policeman comes to your door, which doesn't happen, well, maybe it happens to you. It doesn't happen to me.
they're always after Celia.
Yeah, right.
They're after once a week.
if he knocks on the door and says, you know, get out, there's a wall of water coming down the valley, you're probably going to take that seriously. Really seriously, and you probably will get out unless you're very stubborn. Right? But in many parts of the developing world, if a policeman shows up at your door and tells you to get out, your first thought is, he's here to rip me off. It's just a ploy, not unreasonably, given what actually happens in some countries. And so, you know, the strategies that might work in Miami might not work in certain cities, say in Central America, and you have to be clever about it. I mean, you find out that if it's the priest who comes to the door in Honduras and knocks on your door and says, get out, then you pay attention. So that means if you want to work with the emergency people in certain countries, you work with the clergy and not necessarily with the government as much. And these are the things that we have to learn about how to transmit knowledge.
On that note, Dr. Emanuel, just to follow up real quickly, we had Katrina happen. We've long heard about cities such as Tampa, which are at risk. What other U.S. cities and cities around the world are vulnerable to a Katrina-like event? And is it just a matter of time till we see one of those?
There are many cities that are vulnerable, maybe not quite as vulnerable as New Orleans, because New Orleans has the attribute of being essentially below sea level. You mentioned Tampa. We're worried about Tampa, but other places include Galveston again and Miami, of course, and some of the big cities along the southeast U.S., and New England. New England has not had a really big hurricane since 1938, which was devastating. It killed more than 600 people and blew down 80% of the forests of New England. It was a colossal catastrophe, completely unforecast at its time. And we know from looking at evidence of hurricanes, believe it or not, in the geological records, that over a long period of time, these big, big storms occur there about once every 150 years on the average. If you take a little drive along the south coast of Long Island or Connecticut or Rhode Island, we are set up for a disaster. Again, it's just a matter of time.
I wanted to get back to your comment about this societal-based vulnerability. I think we have segments of our citizens that rely on, shall we say, engineers to mitigate the threat of these types of storms by putting in or reinforcing coastlines against storm surge events or design and building structures that are more resistant to the wind damage or a variety of other things. And I read in your comments that although this is justified up to a degree, we have to acknowledge that there are indeed limits to which we can mitigate the threat of these storms. And maybe the discussion falters when we start acknowledging those limits and really talking about making mitigation measures that somehow amend our vulnerability itself. Is that kind of one of the messages you're trying to get out there?
It is indeed. I mean, clearly there are a number of things that we can engineer to make ourselves less vulnerable. But as we've seen in New Orleans, With all the engineering that went on there for all the decades, it didn't really do any good. And in some ways, it actually made matters worse. Some of the levees in the coastal regions actually funneled the storm surge into New Orleans. It was worse than not really doing what they were supposed to do. So many of my colleagues and many people who have studied the economics of natural disasters will tell you that the number one thing we should do is to seriously reevaluate policies that have been in place in some cases for decades, whose intent was perfectly good, but which have the effect of making it cheap, easy, and attractive for people to take high risks they don't necessarily know they're taking. So, you know, if I'm going to, if I have the opportunity to buy a lot on the ocean in, say, Georgia or Florida, and I think about building a nice house there if I could afford to do that, I'm not probably, as an average member of the public, going to start thinking carefully about the risks because I don't necessarily know about them or I think they're extremely unlikely. On the other hand, if in trying to price out this house, it turned out that it would cost as much to insure it in a year practically as the house is worth, I say, hey, you know, I'm not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's the pricing that sends the risk signal. Now, we're preventing that form of communication by having state insurance regulators who are under enormous political pressure by well-connected people with property on the beach to keep those rates capped and down. So we prevent that signal from getting there. And people say, why not? Why shouldn't they say that? It's the policies that we have to reevaluate.
Some argue still that our global temperature rise is caused by a natural cycle, that we're essentially still headed for the top of a climatic optimum between ice ages. We can measure global CO2 rising, the rate of increase. What can we say for sure about the anthropogenic link to climate change?
Well, in science, nothing is ever sure. No, not even Newton's laws are, off limits. And it's a question of degree. And if you had asked me this 20 years ago, what I would have told you and what I did tell people 20 years ago is, look, we have a body of theory and we have models that tell us the world should warm up to some degree if you pump up CO2, but I don't see the signal yet in the data because there's natural variability. And we are getting better and better and better at understanding what the perfectly natural fluctuations and what's causing them. So, for example, volcanoes and varying sunlight have effects on climate. 20 years have gone by and several things have changed. The models have gotten better. The theory is more refined. But most importantly, we have 20 years more data during which the signal has, I think, in the minds of everybody I talk to and myself, so clearly emerged from the background natural variability that it's just very tough to deny that connection anymore. And I think what you're seeing amongst the few people you can find is a kind of a rear guard action among people well known in my community to be driven, if you will, by ulterior motives. But the serious scientists, all of the serious scientists I know, don't deny this anymore.
Mark Seeley, comment?
I think I've come to the same conclusion as Carrie on that based on recent experience. And getting back to the public policy arena, the fact that we can now attribute the human fingerprint on changes, measurable changes in climate over particularly the last two decades is reason enough to seriously consider community-wide policy actions that deal with this, whether we start at the local scale or we ramp up to state or regional or national scale. And you see more and more examples of this. In fact, Carrie, I think one of the broader than just the hurricane arena, I think one of the attributes of the recent IPCC reports this year was acknowledgement that more local scale modeling and looking at the local causes of climate change might lead to more pointed mitigation work, that we might be able to really do something in regional or landscape context to start mitigating effects. At least that was an underlying message, I think, that was coming out this year. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And I would say that in my dealings with people, over the last few years. One of the most heartening developments is to see how the very young generation, people who are in grade school now and high school, are starting in this country to make it their problem, to make it their own problem to deal with. And it's amazing to see that a lot of high schools now have voluntary student groups that are set up to deal with global warming. And these aren't fanatics, and they're not people who are strongly politically motivated. It's not like the 60s. They're soberly going about assessing the problem and asking what they as individuals can do, and also as larger groups like the school or the town and ultimately the country and the international community can do. So I'm pessimistic that our generation is going to do much, to be honest with you, but I'm optimistic that our children's generation will be able to do something about this. I hope it's not too late.
That's an excellent way to end it, too. Get people thinking. It's been our pleasure having you with us on Jet Streaming, Doctor. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
You know, we spent most of the time today with Dr. Emanuel, so we have just enough time for the weather website of the week. Delayed reaction. That's good.
That happens when the lightning's far away.
I know. Thank you so much. All right, Mr. Huttner.
Well, you know, this is a great resource for anybody that's looking for Carey's work, Much of It All in One Place, his own website, a terrific resource. The link to Divine Wind, the History of Science and Hurricanes, papers, data, graphics pertaining to tropical cyclone trends and variability, all that good weather geeky hurricane stuff, it's all there. Wind.mit.edu. / and I believe that's a tilde then they call it,
yes.
Emanuel, E-M-A-N-U-E-L, /home.html, or just Google Carey Emanuel and you'll find it. Good stuff there, Doctor.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much, Paul Huttner.
Thanks, Kathy.
Dr. Seeley.
Thank you, Kathy.
We'll see you again next week. A reminder, if you have a question or an idea for a Jet Streaming segment, don't be shy. Just check it out. Jet Streaming, podcast section, minnesotapublicradio.org. Until next time, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.